threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Were the Nazis essentially modern-day prophets of Baal? Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest has done some really interesting research and compiled it into what appears to be a really important work that we'll discuss over the next 45 minutes to an hour. He is, perhaps somewhat prophetically, a graduate of Evergreen State College in Washington, served time as a missionary overseas to the former Soviet Union, and has come up with a book that is fascinating in that it ties the modern-day environmental movement through the Nazis of Adolf Hitler all the way back to Baal and the worship of Baal in the days of ancient Israel. It's a pleasure to welcome to the bunker Mark Musser, author of the book Nazi Oaks. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege.
I first heard about your work and your book through a photo that was posted to Facebook by Carl Teichrib. And I figured, you know, Carl is a pretty good judge of character, and if anybody's a friend of Carl's, he's probably worth talking to. So found a video online of a prophecy conference at which you spoke, where you were introduced by Dr. Tommy Ice of the Pre-Trib Research Center. And it was a compelling discussion, and I'm thankful that your book is on the way. I look forward to reading it once we get it. Nazi Oaks. When we think of the Nazis today, we think of the genocide of the Jews. We think of their search to create the perfect genetic race, the Aryan race. But we don't really think of environmentalism. What are the links between the Nazi Party and the Green Movement?
Well, the links between those two things is that ecology was actually coined by a man named Ernst Haeckel. And he was really the father of what we call German social Darwinism. He was a German interpreter of Darwin's evolutionary theory. He applied it to society. And this is the very man who really becomes the father of what we would call eugenics, really, and especially particularly in Germany. And then he's the very guy that encouraged or actually promoted and even coined the term ecology back in 1866. And so a lot of his ideas about ecology connected with Darwinism are going to be really scientifically brought together in his worldview. And by the way, his books are very popular. By the turn of the century, you know, they were bestsellers. You know, and he talked about, again, social Darwinism, ecology, nature, and really, he's kind of a strange guy. Even though he's a scientist, really, what he's emphasizing is sort of a pantheistic view of nature, where pantheism means, you know, God is a part of nature; he's not above nature. And so he actually emphasized a pantheism as well, along with this, which some environmentalists do today with, you know, they have Gaia, they have nature worship, and some other things that are popular among a lot of people. And really, Ernst Haeckel laid the foundations for bringing those things together, science, social Darwinism, and ecology, and they're still with us today. Now, people may emphasize environmentalism more so today than they did back in Haeckel's day, but nonetheless, those foundations were laid in the 1800s, and Germany is really at the heart of the environmental movement and its beginnings and even high influences coming out of Germany, especially from 1850 to about 1900. You know, this is when the environmental movement was laid down, and most of those foundation stones were laid in Germany.
The ecological movement and the eugenics movement then apparently have some parallels or some links. 90 years ago, eugenics was considered the pinnacle of modern science. How does this view of man as just one more type of animal in the pantheon of creation influence this eugenics movement, this drive to somehow improve upon the genetic design created by God?
Well, many of the Germans, environmentalism really starts with Romanticism back in the early 1800s, and we have Goethe as sort of the father of German Romanticism. He sort of shied away from it when he got a little bit older, but still very romantically in tune. And by that Romanticism, I mean you have a romantic view about nature. You want to go back to some idyllic Garden of Eden of some sort to get away from the modern stresses of the modern industrial world. And so this was sort of their thinking. They also were very upset with the worship of reason, with the Enlightenment, as they sort of categorize everything too rationally and too much emphasis upon reason. There's other aspects of the human being, like his passions, his instincts, you know, his emotions that we need to also emphasize. And so the Romanticism wanted to get back to those things too, even like things like willpower rather than thought. And so these things were turning in the background of Germany for a number of years. And so they wanted to kind of get back to nature. Later on, social Darwinism is added on top of that whole mix. And what really develops is that the idea was if we get back to nature, we can become strong again. If we get back to nature and nature's evolutionary laws or even its romantic laws, we can improve our species. And so what they complained about is that the Jews and the Christians, they gave us a otherworldly emphasis upon the transcendental world, the heavenly world, and the world that's outside of ourselves. And what we need to do is get back to nature. And what they complained about is that really what Jews and Christians gave to the world was sort of a corrupting influence in the sense that it weakened the races in particular, because now that what we're doing, we're taking care of people. We're being nice to them. We don't, especially people that have special needs and that type of stuff, we're ministering to them. And as they survive and as they propagate, it's going to make the race worse and worse. And so that's how eugenics and environmentalism are tied, because what they viewed is that we need to have a pure environment in order to have a good eugenics, you know, in order for us to evolve properly. We need to get back to nature, and a part of that would be through environmental type activities. So that's how they are connected. It's a very mm-hmm. strange thing. Interesting enough, the Nazis viewed themselves as the master race precisely because they were the most in tune with nature. That's what they believed.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And so, okay, then social Darwinism makes sense. We need to...
Yeah, exactly. And these are all elements that have been buried. For some reason, they haven't been emphasized. I think there's a lot of good reasons why. The one book in particular, a couple of books in particular, I would highly recommend that really nails this down is Daniel Gassman. He's not a Christian, but he's talked about Ernst Haeckel and his social Darwinian views, his views about nature, his views about really kind of what he calls a nature worship. And he calls this the scientific origins of national socialism. And this is the book that is controversial, but, you know, he has really done an excellent job nailing those things down. Another book he calls, it's called Modern Fascism, you know, Haeckel's Monism and Modern Fascism, how they're connected. And see, monism is where you view everything as one.
Right,
mono
right.
means one. And what they're doing is that monism, Haeckel, see, social Darwinism is a form of monism. And monism, you interpret everything according to inside of nature. There's no transcendental features that we're going to relate to from the outside to teach us, to remind us, or warn us, or whatever. Everything is going to be from the inside. And so monism was something which today we call it social Darwinism. But in those days, Haeckel called it monism. And so this worship of nature is also connected to it. And so I would highly recommend those two books by Daniel Gassman.
That's really interesting because monism is, according to theologian Peter Jones, the dominant worldview today, and that it is infiltrating the modern evangelical church. This idea that we're somehow all interconnected, obviously is very Eastern in outlook, that we're all part of a greater whole, and we just have somehow forgotten it. We need to get back to that.
Well, the other thing, too, people don't realize that when people started drifting east, you know, intellectually, this began in Germany, and especially with existentialists like Schopenhauer and some other men emphasizing that, you know, the Eastern peoples don't have a problem with nature. It's only the Western peoples that do. They want to subjugate nature. They want to be mean to animals. This is something that was given to them from the book of Genesis when Adam and Eve were made, you know, put in the garden, and man is above nature, and he can be named all the animals, and he can treat the animals with contempt if he wants to, and there's no consequences to this. And so he complained about this kind of stuff. And Schopenhauer really is also a very important figure. He's a German philosopher. He follows Goethe, and he lays really the foundation for what we would call animal rights or environmental ethics. And so now his ideas are actually very permeated the entire environmental movement today. And Adolf Hitler, interesting enough, is that Schopenhauer was his favorite philosopher. And along with this, Schopenhauer was extremely anti-Semitic. So when he started talking about Jews, he blew a gasket. And the biggest complaint that he had about the Jews is they were unnatural. And the reason why is because of Genesis. You know, God has made man's image. He's above nature. He doesn't exist in a monistic world, but actually there's a dualism that's taught in the Bible. So the man is certainly made in nature. He's a part of nature, but he's also above nature because he's made in God's image. And that's exactly where environmentalists, they attack the image of God that's in man. They reduce it down to the level of animals, and then we're sort of in a monistic, holistic, social Darwinian one, which they want to emphasize, and then there's no contact now with God or with transcendental values.
Right.
So that's really what it's all about, yeah.
And this also feeds into the transhumanist movement. Wesley J. Smith at National Review Online does an excellent job of cataloging all of these, the creep of this attack on human exceptionalism, the idea that we are somehow set above the animals, made in God's image, basically set over his creation here on Earth in as his moral agents, essentially serving the same role over Earth more or less as God serves over all of creation, or at least that was the intention at the beginning.
Yeah, no, he's done some excellent work too. Dr. Peter Jones, Wesley Smith, I mean, he's done a lot of great stuff on this. I just watched a really good documentary that he put together here just a couple days ago, and talking about animal rights and how this is really going to be...
Yeah.
It's getting hairy because what's going to happen is that lawyers are going to start representing animals and they're going to start suing us.
Right, exactly. In fact, yeah. I've talked about that on the some of the daily news updates I've done here recently for Skywatch TV. And we're working on a documentary now here at, Tom Horn has been working on for several years. And Wesley J. Smith is one of the experts he consulted and will be part of this documentary called Inhuman on the desire to. And this is the ironic thing about it, Mark, is that this almost insane desire to deny the exceptionalism of humanity, and yet to turn around and say we alone have the capacity and the moral responsibility to direct evolution. It's like
I know it's contradictory.
And, it is. It's,
but see, they don't care because their view is existential. And existentialism is that human emotions, human instinct, biology, these are more important than your thought. So they don't really care that you may be intellectually inconsistent or, that's not important to them. So really environmentalism and those types of ideas are rooted in what we would call existentialism.
Mm.
And by that, existence trumps thought. Existence
gotcha.
Trumps
okay.
Beings. And it takes over. And so rational consistency is not something which they really care about that much, even though, maybe on their articles and the things that they talk about scientifically, they want to give a front that they're really super scientific. When in fact it's just a lot of emotions that are being spread all over the place, and it's not really based on science at all.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of theology that's coming out of our churches today is based on how it makes us feel.
Exactly. No, it's the same. See, Schleiermacher plays an important role there too, and he was a romantic theologian, and he's about the same time as Goethe and Schopenhauer. And so his theological liberalism, we call it today, really is at the heart of that. Feeling is more important than reason, or how you feel is more important than the doctrines you hold. And so, these are interesting to me. There's so many important German figures that have had too much influence over our academics and how we view things. And I don't know why we have given so much deference to these Germans. It's really a strange operation that is going on, even with regard to higher criticism of the Bible. Even though their theories have been shown to be false, again, the Germans led the charge on this. And to me, these things are actually connected. And it's a very interesting discussion because they emphasize natural theology based on their views of nature and God rather than from the Bible. And so this led to a lot of attacks against the historicity of the Bible. And they're going to show that, God doesn't exist, or that maybe not that he doesn't exist, but, the Bible itself is not something we can be trusted. And so we're going to develop our own natural theology, our own ideas about God. And, of course, with that comes a God of feelings, a God of sentimentality. And, of course, we have a lot of this going on today.
Yeah. I would argue, and I know this is slightly off topic, and I don't want to deviate too far away from the subject of your book, Nazi Oaks, but I would argue that the Nazis didn't necessarily lose World War II. Whole purpose of what's been going on, in fact, since the 19th century, has been almost a cross-pollination of ideas coming out of Germany with ideas.
Oh, I agree. The ideas are still there. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. And things coming from the United States, because frankly, it was the model that was developed in the state of California that provided the model that the Nazis used to implement their final solution.
Well, you know, one of the things that people talk about, they overlook, is that California was getting a lot of their ideas also out of Germany. So Haeckel already had his best-selling book by the time the California eugenics took over, and a lot of people are ignoring that.
Mm.
And, you know, even the Sierra Nevadas has a mountain named after him, and that was named like in the 1890s. So there was already some influences there coming out of Germany. Even Humboldt is another important, what I would call a racist, almost like a, what they call a Volkish environmentalist, but, you know, Volkish is almost like a racial connotation. But mm-hmm. anyway, there's some, also Mendel is another one. They have mountains named after these people.
Mm-hmm.
So California absorbed a lot of Haeckel's social Darwinism back in the late 1800s. And then, of course, they're going to set up their own eugenics program in the state of California in the early 1900s.
Right, right. And, well, again, it's deviating somewhat into a different topic. But, yeah, there, again, the idea that developed and grew to fruition yeah. with Nazi Germany didn't go away. When
no.
in 1945, because we're seeing it now with a scientific veneer in the transhumanist movement, which is nothing but repackaged eugenics.
Well, what? Yeah, exactly. And it's going to make the Nazi eugenics look like real primitive.
Exactly. Right.
Anyway, another thing to really think about here is that, interestingly enough, today in America, between 40 to 50% of all the books published in America today are actually published by two German conglomerates. One of them is Bertelsmann, and the
right.
other one is Holzbring. And they produce anywhere between 40 to 50% of all the books produced in America. And both of these publishing houses were extreme Nazi companies back in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And so now today they have a hegemony over the book publishing business. And any big publisher that you know about, its name, I almost guarantee it's run by either Bertelsmann or Holzbring.
Just a division of one of those two companies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about a little bit about some of the manifestations during Nazi Germany. I think when most of us think about the technology or about the German war machine in the 1930s, 1940s, that's probably what comes to mind first when you think about Nazi Germany, the amazing engineering accomplishments that vaulted Germany to the very forefront of the world in terms of technology. Under Adolf Hitler, especially coming out of the horrible conditions that existed in the 20s, during the 20s in Germany, most of us don't consider or aren't even aware that the Germans were really, really green, as we define the word today. What were some examples of the environmental policies of the Nazis?
Well, the first order of business, 1933, they passed an animal rights law. And it was also an anti-Semitic animal rights law. And so this is where the first order of business. Goering was also behind this. Hitler was too. And this goes back to Schopenhauer. So Schopenhauer was very, according to Hitler, Schopenhauer was his favorite philosopher. Number two, his second favorite philosopher was Nietzsche. And so Schopenhauer was going to have a big influence on how Hitler thought about animal rights. And so this really goes back to Schopenhauer's legacy. And so that's going to be 1933. 1934, and really closely associated with this, Goering passed a green Nazi hunting law, probably the first really hunting laws that we've seen anywhere in the world, actually had some teeth to it, that actually meant something. And a lot of people praised, his green Nazi hunting law. Also interesting, 1934, a Seattle-based animal rights group, they gave Hitler the Michael Bager Humane Award, so, you know, for being nice to animals. So, out of Seattle, interestingly enough.
Yeah.
Then also, 34, the Nazis started implementing what they called Dauerwald forest practices. You know, my German pronunciation is not very good, but Dauerwald means eternal forest. So the idea of sustainable forestry was what they were going to emphasize. By the way, the Nazis also began what we call sustainable development. You know, they were really the originators of this.
Really?
A lot of things, yeah. So the kind of what happened is that the racism and the environmentalism came together. See, on the one hand, we want to develop because we're racist. On the other hand, we want to respect nature. And so what happened is that they really became the forerunners of what we would call sustainable development. So the racism mixed with environmentalism, and that mixture created what we call sustainable development.
Hmm.
So that was it, especially from the later 30s, early 40s. And they had all kinds of sustainable plans designed for the Eastern Front. You know, so after they won the war, they were going to turn that into a German green paradise of sustainable development for the German people. That's what all kinds of sustainable development plans were laid out and implemented, at least written out that they were going to do in the Eastern Front. Of course, the war effort went bad, so they didn't work out.
So Eastern Front, you're talking about Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah, Ukraine was going to be, Hitler was going to cover Ukraine with windmills. And they were going to, turn Poland into, there's a beautiful national park, for example, in there. They're going to make this huge national park. They were going to make these German green village cities. They were going to have green garden parks. They were going to have frontier farms. I mean, they were going to depopulate the area first and then move in German.
Oh.
No, it's an amazing story that needs to be told. A lot of people don't know this, is that they put into practice a lot of environmental plans.
This really actually hits kind of close to home, because as we mentioned to discussing, my ancestors on my mother's side are of German descent, but they left the area around Stuttgart in the early 19th century at the invitation of Catherine the Great and wound up settling in Ukraine north of Odessa and then moved a little westward into what is today Moldova. But within the last couple of years, connected with a distant cousin whose branch of the family opted to stay when my ancestors came over in 1894 and settled in the Dakotas. His branch stayed, but they were settled in Poland in the 1930s. And this young man told me through email that his grandfather had been settled and the family had been settled on a farm in Poland that had been vacated. But they found out after they'd been there for a while that it had been vacated by the SS and that many Germans had been moved from Ukraine, from what is now Moldova, into this area. And his grandfather was not comfortable with it for some reason. And they wound up moving moving back to the area near Bonn. So they may have actually been part of this program.
Yeah, sure. They called the resettlement plan. And Himmler and Dare had all kinds of, cockamamie racial environmental plans for Poland in particular, but also Ukraine and Belarus. And,
wow.
Part of that was connected to the farms. And so they were going to, they were interested in organic farming. By the way, Himmler was interested in these things. Dare eventually became interested. He was also a very high up SS man. He trained Himmler in some of his green ideas. And so these things really go back a long way. Dachau, for example, had an organic farm on it. Even Auschwitz had like a botanical garden, experimental garden. They were fooling around with different things. And so, there's a lot of environmental undercurrents going on, even in the Holocaust itself.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned
in 1935, the Nazis passed the Reich Nature Protection Act, which really has become very similar to what has become the heart of environmentalism. This is not where you simply set aside a wilderness preserve. What you do now is that you require social engineering on private property according to environmental rules. Now, this has really taken over much environmental movement today. And so now that your private property can be socially engineered through environmental regulations, this really goes back to 1935, the Reich Nature Protection Act.
Wow.
Even the four-year plan that the Nazis came up with, the economic plan, to run the war, was supposedly, at least on paper, was to be regulated by environmental spatial planning. What they called it back then was spatial planning. That's how they viewed it. Even today, the European Union calls it spatial planning. So that's what they would call environmental planning. So a lot of interesting connections there.
And here in the United States, we're seeing it manifest in things like the recent regulation issued by the EPA to control all waterways and defining it down to the point where even...
Yeah, connected to stormwater. See, and stormwater was... A lot of people don't realize this is a big deal. Going back 1990s, but it's early 2000s, this was their major push, and they've already taken over the stormwater. And one of the original gurus of stormwater management was Alan Seifert, and he was a SS Nazi. And he was really a very important, influential person in getting stormwater management pushed in even in Nazi Germany, let alone even today. So he's really the father of this.
Yeah, and stormwater, when you're on a farm, I mean, basically a lot of it is what you use to irrigate your crops. And if you've got little canals or channels or ditches dug in order to channel the water where you need it, the government was, with this regulation, attempting to assert its authority over that water, weren't they?
Well, what they're worried about, at least what they say they're concerned about, is that when it rains and you work your property, is that stormwater, it mixes with pollution in some way, whether erosion or this and that and the other, or even, your tractor, gas and oil, whatever it may be, or even pesticides, too much fertilizer, see, all those kinds of things. eventually wind up in the waterways. And so that's what they want to clean up. That's their reasoning as to what they want to do. And so they don't necessarily are concerned you may drain your soil, or that may be a problem, but bigger stormwater leads to pollution, and that stormwater eventually goes down to the river system. That's what they're trying to get on top of.
Right, right. But by regulating it the way they did, they were essentially suggesting to farmers that even the ditches, the EPA would have control over, and then everyday tasks on the farm would be subject to EPA regulations that had never been regulated before.
No. This is a totalitarian worldview. Environmentalism and Nazi Germany are perfectly, you know, they're both totalitarian. They're both monistic. They don't allow people to be above nature, to work nature. You know, my personal view on this is that, yeah, man does bring changes to nature, but that's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always bad, certainly. And a lot of people view that as bad today because we have this Garden of Eden idea of nature, that nature is this wonderful, romantic, you know, feel-good thing that you can enjoy. And but most people do that sitting in their modern homes with all the modern conveniences they enjoy. If you really had to live in nature, it would not be very pleasant.
Yeah.
And so they really have too many romantic ideas about nature, and they're not really given any really any leeway at all about all the positive things that industrialism has brought to our modern society at all. And you know, there's a one-sided view of everything. And you know, people back in the old days, I mean, you know, you lived on rotten food for, you know, 6 months out of the year. Most kids died of childhood diseases. You know, if you were and you were lucky to get to 60 years old, you know, all this people just they think getting back to nature is going to be wonderful. It's not. By the way, even food, they processed the heck out of food back then too. Even probably worse than we do today. They filled it full of salt, especially meat. I mean, because food would not couldn't preserve itself, and then they had to eat it right now because. No, we're just fed a whole bunch of lies and people don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, the introduction to your book, Nazi Oaks, is titled The Green Nazi Motive of the Holocaust. You mentioned the Holocaust earlier. What possible link could there be between the Holocaust and environmentalism?
Well, one of the things that Schopenhauer and other German environmentalists in the 1800s emphasized is that the Jews were unnatural. And part of this is because, again, it goes back to Genesis. Man is made in God's image. He's above nature. And so they really attack that, you know, that whole emphasis. And this is going to carry over into National Socialism as well. And so the idea is why we're going to get rid of the Jews is because they're unnatural. And, you know, one of the most important documentary films made in the 1930s was called The Eternal Jew. Okay, the idea of eternity. See, it's like they're above nature. And the most heinous, you know, they go through a whole description of all the things that the Jewish people did. They run dirty cities. You know, they don't know how to work out in the countryside. They're running the financial markets, and they're on top of the food chain, and they're, you know, exploiting people with their money and this and that and the other. But interesting enough, the climax of this movie, this documentary, centers around animal rights. And they show three different cows, for example, with regard to kosher slaughter, how the Jewish people do kosher slaughter because they're not allowed to drink blood.
Mm-hmm.
But they do it in a special way, especially, you know, according to some practices, not all the Jews necessarily do it this way, but they really highlighted a particular way where they, you know, they kill these animals and yet they let the blood all come out before they're totally dead. And so they use this as an example of animal abuse. And so they showed different cows being killed in this way, also different sheep and this and that and the other. This goes on and on. The blood and gore is really bad. And then finally, at the end of this climax here, for the first time, Adolf Hitler shows up in the movie. And then this is where he's in the Reichstag in 1939, and he promises that he's going to, you know, send the Jews to hell for, you know, for starting another world war. And they also thank Hitler for passing this animal rights law. And so it's a very important documentary that was highly influential in Germany. And one of the reasons why they got, probably one of the most important reasons why they got rid of the Jews is because they considered to be unnatural. You know, and they emphasized an unnatural way of life, which was contrary to eugenics. And Hitler himself was going to be the very wolf that was going to clean up the pack, the wolf pack. And, you know, he viewed his SS, for example, as, you know, he called himself, called the SS his pack of wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to clean. They were, of course, the primary progenitors of racism and eugenics, and they were going to clean up the German race. See, and so their depopulation program is a part of this. It's nature-based, rooted in nature, and they viewed themselves as between animals and people, almost like people are animals, and so they're going to treat people like animals. And when they stuffed Jews in cattle cars, for example, interesting enough, on the same trains, they had special animal rights laws that were very strict, that were abided by on same trains. So Jews were stepped in like as many as they could get in. And then when it came to animals, however, transport of animals, there were strict, Nazis had strict animal rights laws on how they were to be transported. So, you know, here we have this strange world, mm-hmm. and very evil. People are treated like terrible animals. And my contention in the book is that, you know, they did this on purpose. They knew what they were doing. And they're blaming the Jews for their bad attitudes toward nature. Now you guys are going to pay the price for your bad attitudes about nature. And even many Jews were treated like experimental animals. You know, this is going to go on at Auschwitz and other mm-hmm. places. And that was part of their program, is they had no distinction between man and nature. And so they did live experiments on people. Okay, we use experimental animals to do that. And they did it on people. This was part of their worldview, part of how they thought. And it's not something that we look at as, well, how do they manage to do that? You know, well, it's because of their Darwinian views, because of their views about nature, their environmental views, that there's no distinction between man and nature. And so that's part of this whole process. And the Holocaust really has a lot of environmental things churning underneath, underground, but underwater element as a part of it.
Hmm. Now, the Jews were blamed by the Nazis for this this idea that man was somehow superior to nature, was granted dominion over nature. And, of course, the book of Genesis is in the Bible that's used by Christians as well. So why didn't the Christian churches in Germany take any of the blame for this?
Well, they were next on the list. And, you know, there's a lot – if you look at Hitler's table talk, he talks about Christianity being anti-natural. He talks about them being a protest against nature, and – he had the same, basically, Hitler viewed the Christians as basically they made Judaism universal. And he viewed as science and nature is going to overcome Christianity eventually. And the only, they didn't attack Christianity as directly during that time because they couldn't do it all. But that they were going to be the next target. They get rid of the Jews first, next target on the list is going to be the Christians.
Hmm.
So they were going to be number two.
What was any... And I wonder this only because of the way the church in modern day America has secularized in a way to be less offensive to those raised in our scientistic society. You know, we're not anti-science. We were probably the product of evolution, but we still believe in, you know, Jesus anyway. Did that factor into things? I mean, why didn't the German churches stand up and say, hey, wait a minute? You know, this isn't right, and what you're doing is based on a direct contradiction to what we see in the Word of God.
Well, it's because the German theology, the German natural theology of the 1800s laid the foundation for that, or existentialism, romanticism, like Schleiermacher, feelings are more important than doctrine. And so those ideas invaded their theology and invaded their churches, and so people didn't notice the difference. You know, they thought existentialism and romanticism was spiritual, see, and that reason was anti-spiritual. And so that dichotomy in their own minds was how they viewed it. And so they used their reason, biology, and instinct to attack reason. And that was actually part and parcel of what this is all about.
Up is down, down is up. War is peace.
Oh, no, it's just amazing. It's
and we've always been at war with it. Yeah, it's... it's astonishing. One of the really intriguing things about the book, and the reason I'm really eager to read it, is your opening chapters deal with, you know, stepping back in history to the time of ancient Israel and the struggles that they had, both internally mm-hmm. and with their neighbors externally, who venerated Baal. And, you know, this was a problem that plagued the Hebrews from the time of Moses onward. I mean, we read in... The book of Exodus, where they're about to cross the Red Sea. And this struck me a few weeks ago, and I keep mentioning it because to me this just was like profound. I'd never heard this before in the story of the crossing of the Red Sea. But just before they cross, God tells Moses to tell the Israelites, turn around, go back. And they crossed the Red Sea at a place opposite of a location called Baal Zephon, which is... was known as, you know, Lord of the North. It was the translation. But in the ancient world, Baal or Mount Zaphon, which is in the northern part of Syria today, was known as Baal's Holy Mountain, where his palace was located. But Baal was venerated, point being, in Egypt in circa 1500 BC, and the worship of Baal was a thorn in the side of the Israelites all through the Old Testament. How do you connect the environmental movement of the 1940s, the Germans in the 30s and 40s, the environmental movement today, all the way back to 3,500 years to ancient Israel?
Well, Baal is basically, if you want to look at it, it's really kind of a it's an early form of environmentalism. And so what they did in Baalism is that Baal was the nature god. He was a storm god. He was in charge of the weather. And what they did is that people were required to make sacrifices to the nature god for the sake of fertility of nature. And some of that included also, by the way, child sacrifice as a part of that whole operation. And so that really is rooted deeply into their thinking. And by the way, I would actually view National Socialism as really a modern fertility cult. And so the eugenics and fertility, I would put, it's just sort of a more modernized version of, eugenics is sort of a modernized version of a fertility cult, dressed up in modern science.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of the connection that I make in the book. But Baalism was very popular with the Jewish people. By the way, Baalism, environmentalism, very popular today with many Christians. People could not tell the difference between Baal and God. Basically Baal means Lord, and so they used these terms interchangeably. Even Hitler himself would talk about the Lord, but he didn't mean the God of the Bible, whom he hated. He believed in pantheism. And so every time he used the word Lord, a lot of people think he was talking Christian. No, he wasn't. He was talking about a pantheistic God as a part of nature. And, of course, he was going to be the guy that was going to help bring back Germany to, nature's laws and evolution and eugenics. And he's going to be the guy that's going to be the very wolf to help bring this all about. So anyway, Baalism was very popular with a lot of people in Israel's day. It helped to ransack their economy. It destroyed their foundations of their country. And if you look at how Baalism worked, they worshipped underneath the trees, the oak trees in particular. And the connection in my book is that the Germans loved oak trees. And there's a lot of oak worship in, mm-hmm. in National Socialism. And, for example, Hitler gave oak trees to all the gold medal winners of the 1936 Olympics. Jesse Owens came home with four of them.
Wow.
Glenn Morris out of Colorado had one. He came home with another one. Some of them are still living. The Nazis planted oaks all over the Reich, all over Poland, other places. And interesting, there's even some oak symbolism connected to the Holocaust, too, with regard to Auschwitz. The gas chamber doors are made of solid oak, and this is also true in Treblinka. And, of course, even at Auschwitz itself, there's some interesting oak trees that are actually there, big oak trees, right at the camp itself.
Just past that sign that said...
Probably were planted by the Nazis. I haven't been able to confirm that yet. Anyway, they're certainly connected to that camp, and they were certainly taken care of in a special way. And the Nazis loved the oaks, and so they worshiped the oaks. And by the way, Thor, which is that's the Germanized version of Baal, Thor means the god of the oaks. And Zeus is too, by the way. He means god of the oaks. And so basically Zeus, Baal, Thor, they're all the same guy. And it goes back to Nimrod. It's just... back in the early Genesis chapter 11, it's just different, translations of different cultural ideas of how they viewed Nimrod and the worship of him.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It all stems from the same source. I mean,
It goes back to Tower of Babel. Ultimately.
Yeah. And we're dealing with the principalities and the powers and the rulers of spiritual darkness here.
Sure.
I was trying to do some quick research here, and I'm going to have to dig more into this later on because, we've been looking at CERN, the research lab, the Large Hadron Collider, but the link between the name of the laboratory there, which has nothing, CERN was the original name, and then they changed it, but they kept the acronym, but it's also a shortened form of the name of the Celtic horn god Cernunnos, and I'm gonna have to do some more digging into that because that was the green horned man. Again, kind of a nature. Connotation or nature worship connotation there, but again, I'm getting into an area where I really don't know anything. Just a possible link, but the thing that struck me during the description of Baal worship, child sacrifice, which today we here in the United States have sacrificed 50 million or more than 50 million now since Roe v. Wade, and much of that justified on the basis of not contributing to overpopulation, not placing more people on Mother Gaia than she can support. Again, being justified as part of a veneration of the creation over the creator.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the Celts, the Druids are supposedly the men of the oaks. That's what it means. Supposedly.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, the oak tree is actually pretty powerful, and they committed animal sacrifices too underneath the oak trees. That's where the sacred tree, the oak tree. You see, the idea of the oak trees are strong and powerful, and so, you know, they represent the strong fertility of nature, and so the oak is actually very important, you know, object of worship in the ancient pagan worldview.
The one of the goals of Hitler, and maybe this was, you know, part of just the ultimate goal, was to try to reestablish his government, his nation, as the 20th century embodiment of ancient Rome. You know, what is the tie between this environmental movement, the veneration of nature, and this desire to recreate Rome?
Well, you know, if you think about Romanticism, there's a lot of romantic ideas about the Greco-Roman Empire too. So mm-hmm. It's all connected. Even Goethe, for example, the father of Romanticism, you know, he makes a comment: "Oh, I wish that you know, Homer was the foundation of our country rather than the Bible." See, and then they have these romantic ideas about the Greeks and Romans, and Hitler did too. And really, when they started to replace the classics, you know, in the sense that they venerated the classics above the Bible, you know, that really is a part of that romantic emphasis as well. And by the way, Hitler defines fascism, you know how he defines it?
Hmm.
As a spontaneous return to the traditions of Rome. That's how he defined it. And where do you ever hear this on a definition of fascism? You don't. Yet that's exactly how the Fuhrer defined it himself. And you know, these are important concepts. He wanted to bring back the Greco-Roman Empire. And he viewed the Spartans, for example, as something to be emulated, you know, a warrior ethos, you know, lean, mean, and green, really, with regard to, you know, they're closer to nature, they're a part of nature, and that this idea that man is above nature, again, we need to get rid of these ideas. And the Holocaust was also part of how we get rid of those ideas, and that's how they viewed the Jews as being so anti-natural. We need to clean up our race, and so we're going to get rid of these ideas completely.
Hmm. Ideas are spread through the media. The internet has certainly facilitated that, but movies, popular programming, popular entertainment does an awful lot to spread beliefs that might not spread if they were put out as scholarly tomes, scholarly works. For example, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code did a lot more to spread the idea that Jesus and Mary Magdalene went off to the south of France together.
Yeah, no.
Then the book that he drew the idea from, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, because he put a really neat story around it. James Cameron did something similar,
yeah,
for the environmental movement with the movie Avatar. And one of the sections toward the end of your book deals with, just again, as a very intriguing title, The Curious Green Nazi Connection Between Leni Riefenstahl and James Cameron. First of all, who is Leni Riefenstahl, and what link might there be between the work of Cameron
Riefenstahl was basically the Third Reich's documentary film producer, and she produced stunning films of you know, National Socialism and the things they were doing. Most notable, Triumph of the Will, which is a notorious pro-Nazi film that even today, I mean, people they look at it and they're just you know, it has this supposedly casting spell, you know, for people to become Nazis. And she was really the one who developed it and presented it in such a way that was very powerful and very convincing. The other one she did was the Olympics, 1936. So she made a documentary on the 1936 Olympics as well. And Hitler, by the way, you know, he had a little home up there in the mountains, and he spent 6 months out of the year up there. And he had Leni Riefenstahl make a little environmental movie of all the different animals up on his Berghof, they called it, you know, his mountain home. So she was really the film producer for the Third Reich, and James Cameron's favorite producer of all time. He'd studied her, you know, very seriously, was Leni Riefenstahl. By the way, Riefenstahl, after the war, she was denazified, but, you know, her story is kind of unconvincing. She later became involved in Greenpeace. She became involved with trying to protect, some of the black tribes in Africa from being over-industrialized and losing their heritage and the things that they, their primitive cultures.
They're better off living in grass huts with no power.
Yeah,
no
exactly. Yeah. So she was all involved with that. And Cameron loves her work, and basically, there's a interesting article written by what is his last name now? Anyway, he wrote an article. I think it's Von Dasanowski. I can't pronounce it right, but he wrote an article saying that basically Leni Riefenstahl is Rose in the Titanic.
Oh,
and, if you remember the movie Titanic, where this Rose is initially attracted to this dictatorial Englishman. And then, of course, DiCaprio shows up and she falls in love with him, more free guy, and he kind of does what he wants. And so she falls in love with him. And his argument is that basically Cameron is showing how Leni Riefenstahl transferred from her old dictatorial ways to sort of a modern, left free hippie type attitude about the world. And that really Rose is at the heart of that. And there is actually, very interestingly enough, there's also a Nazi film in the Titanic that Nazis made in 1943. And if you compare the versions between James Cameron and the Nazi version back in 1943, it's kind of like Cameron picked up where the Nazi version left off, because there's a love story that's presented there and it's kind of left off. It's like he picks it up from there and then takes it over, carries it over into our modern world. And, of course, the idea of the iceberg in the Nazi movie is more powerful than the ship. So they made a big deal out of that, and that all these stock market people in the Nazi version, they're making all this money and they're going across the North Atlantic. They don't care about nature, and they hit that iceberg and it all comes crumbling down. And this is sort of the point of the movie. And so, James Cameron has similar views to that. And also his, of course, he makes Avatar, and
right.
They're extolling the primitive nature people. By the way, some not National Socialists did too. And there's, for example, Shoenitchin is one of them. He was a green Nazi in those days, back in the 1930s, and he wanted to preserve, the ancient primitive peoples as well as something to be emulated to some extent. The Nazis thought they would do it, yet with a more modernized version, a more sustainable version of it. Because they're protecting their own culture, their own race, from they're like indigenous to their own environment, and they want to protect themselves from the outsiders and the international capitalism and all the things that they brought, the homogenization of culture, which they detested in America. You go to America, you lose your culture. So those are all things that the Nazis were involved in too, and a lot of people don't realize that. But James Cameron, interestingly enough, kind of mimics some of these ideas, and his love for Leni Riefenstahl is kind of troubling. Obviously, he doesn't think he's a Nazi in any way, but there's some issues here that have not been thought about clearly by people, because they don't really know what National Socialists actually believe. Most people really don't know what they believe.
Right.
All they do is they talk about, when you read a book about National Socialism, usually all it is about raw power politics and what they did. It never explains why they did it,
mm-hmm.
or hardly ever. You have some reference to racism, of course, a master race, and that almost like an explanation for everything, when in fact it's much more nuanced than that, much deeper than that, and there's really no discussions about Nazi ideology, interestingly enough. Very, very seldom do you find a good book on that.
Mm. Nazi Oaks is an exploration of the green motives of the Nazi Party and how that manifested in the Holocaust and in I think we can draw some lessons from that and some of the parallels that we see in the green movement today, and in fact the rise or the return of eugenics in its modern form, the transhumanist movement. Mark, where do people find a copy of Nazi Oaks?
You can buy anywhere online. Amazon has it, but other places do too. What I would want to warn is that I have an old version of the book that's still out there. I've tried to take it down, but Amazon keeps it up. I don't know why. But anyway, so you want to make sure you get the newer version, 2015. The older version is still out there, but anyway, just make sure you get the newer version.
Okay, well, I'll put
just type in Nazi Oaks, Mark Musser, and you'll have all kinds of options. you can order even on by phone in some of those online stores.
I'll put a link to the new edition, the 2015 edition, in the show notes at vftb.net. The author is Mark Musser. And Mark, thank you for your time and for your research, and look forward to staying in touch with you, because this is a topic through the transhumanist movement that we will revisit very frequently here.
It's an interesting discussion as well. I'm not an expert in the transhumanism. Carl, that's his stuff. But obviously there's a strong connection here. And fascism provides that worldview to help that stuff. Surprisingly enough, even though they want to transhumanism, that's part of their eugenics, yet there's still this nature worship that's really at the heart of it. And it's really a strange amalgamation of ideas. But it's where we're headed, it looks like, anyway.
Check the show notes for links, vftb.net, for where you can find a copy of Nazi Oaks by Mark Musser. And we will definitely have him back to talk again. This is a topic that caught me by surprise when I first saw the presentation, the online video, and I'll post a link to that as well, by the way, because that was, again, eye-opening in tying together ancient Baalism, the Nazi movement, and the modern environmental movement. It's like the old song, everything old is new again, just like the eugenics movement is coming back repackaged as transhumanism. And those in the movement, I don't believe, really grasp that that's what they're doing. I've said before, and I'll say again, I think most of the people in the movement have a genuine desire to end human suffering, or at least alleviate it as much as possible, and want to promote the technologies of radical life extension for that purpose. But human nature being what it is, that is the direction it's going to be taken, I believe. And that's why we revisit that topic so frequently here on A View from the Bunker. Some items in the news worth talking about. Ramadan is approaching. Ramadan begins on the 17th of June. That is next Wednesday, as you're hearing this. And it is believed by experts watching the Islamic State that they will use Ramadan, as they have the last couple of years, to launch another military offensive. They seem to do that in conjunction with Ramadan. In fact, it was during Ramadan last year that they announced the formation, the creation of the caliphate. So watching for that. And if this won't keep you awake at night, well, then not much does. Intelligence officials in Australia believe that the jihadists in the Islamic State have acquired enough radioactive material to create a dirty bomb, a dirty nuke, as it were. It's a conventional warhead with radiological material around it to make the problem worse. I mean, it's bad enough that they're blowing up a bomb someplace where a lot of people are gathered, but then the radiological material, the radioactive material, makes it worse, because then you've got the fallout after the fact. So that's something that experts are watching. And in fact, in Israel, staff at the Dimona nuclear reactor have been conducting tests on dirty bombs out in the desert. They've exploded a couple and have been measuring the strength of the fallout, the intensity of the radioactivity after the fact, to see how they need to prepare for this kind of an event. So that's something to watch. The Bilderberg Group begins its annual meetings tomorrow. That would be June the 11th. And it's about 140 people this year, people from industry, but primarily finance, banksters, the big energy guys, government officials, of course, Henry Kissinger, who's like a permanent fixture there, will be there. Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, she's there every year. But the Bilderberg Group was founded 65 years ago by the king of Sweden, so that's – or king of the Netherlands, rather, Holland. So that's why they're always present. Interestingly, the chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, will be there this year. And one of the topics of discussion, besides the Middle East, Iran, what to do about a nuclear Iran, what to do about the Islamic State, and so forth, is artificial intelligence. That's on the agenda for the Bilderberg Group this year. And I know that there are some who believe that the Bilderberg Group runs the world. I think it's a little too visible, my own opinion. For the most part, these are people who can't go to a hot dog cart without attracting media attention. And it's a little difficult to carry out secret plans to rule the world when you're that high profile. I suspect that there are others behind the scenes. And of course, looking at it through a biblical perspective, there are the principalities and powers who are behind the scenes that we don't see, But anyway, just be aware that the global elites are gathering this week and this weekend in Austria under Chatham House rules, which basically comes down to this. The first rule of the Bilderberg Group is you don't talk about the Bilderberg Group. The test of the Martian lander conducted by NASA yesterday was a spectacular failure. It was a big, they were calling it a flying saucer, just a big donut-shaped craft that was supposed to be dropped onto the Martian surface at some point in the future with a really, really big parachute. And to simulate the effect on the parachute, they took this craft up into the stratosphere with a really big balloon and then dropped it to see if the parachute would deploy. The idea is that they want to find a way to land really big payloads on the Martian surface, like crew living quarters for a human crew stationed on Mars. Because right now they are planning a Mars, and still very far off. They're talking like 2035. I'll believe it when I see it. But they're kind of anticipating that the trip to Mars is going to be a one-way deal. I mean, there's a lot of energy required to move a craft from Earth to Mars, and so they're not planning a return trip for those folks. So they're going to have to put permanent living quarters down on the surface of Mars. Anyway, as they dropped this from the balloon yesterday, the parachute shredded in the vacuum of space, and so the splashdown was a little larger of a splash than they had actually expected. And speaking of NASA, they are still trying to figure out what's causing those mystery lights, those reflected lights on the dwarf planet Ceres. Ceres is in the asteroid belt. That's that big open gap between Mars and Jupiter. It's the largest object in the asteroid belt, and there's a crater about 55 miles across that has a couple of bright spots on it that the NASA craft, which is called Dawn, has been taking pictures of for quite some time. Dawn is now in orbit around Ceres, about 2,200 miles up, taking pictures, sending back really high-resolution photos, and they still don't have an idea what's causing these two bright spots. Campfires, searchlights, cities, we don't know. it's causing a lot of speculation, and the head of the mission for NASA said that this is so unusual it makes Ceres unique in the solar system. Oh, one more note on the Islamic State, overlooked. They reportedly captured 86 Christians from Eritrea near Tripoli in Libya yesterday. These Eritreans were hoping to catch a boat to make their escape from Africa and get over to Europe. Europe has a as big, if not bigger, problem with illegals coming into the into their countries that we do here in the United States. But these folks were intercepted by the Islamic State, and I would not want to be in their shoes right now. Eritrea, by the way, is a country on the Red Sea. It is on the west coast of the Red Sea, north of Ethiopia, and east of Sudan. So, anyway, just pray for those folks, because right now their future looks like it's, well, they're in the Lord's hands. There's no question about it. But between now and the time that they actually go home to be with the Lord, assuming that that is the condition of their hearts, does not appear that they're going to be in for a very good time. Really bizarre experiment reported on this week from researchers who worked with helium atoms. This was researchers in Australia, the Australian National University. They conducted an experiment that had been performed on light before, which proved the experiment with beams of light proved the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which basically says you can't tell the state of a particle until you observe it. In light, in the case of light, for example, you don't know if it's going to be a wave or a particle until you actually observe it. What makes this experiment, the experiment in Australia, a little different is that this was the first time it was done with matter, with helium atoms, with something that has mass. And they found the same thing. You could not tell whether the helium atoms behaved as a particle or as a wave until they were observed. But further, but even beyond that, they found something else interesting, that the state you observed the helium atoms appeared to be affected by an action that took place after the observation. In other words, they would determine how they were going to measure in what way they were going to observe the helium atoms, and that seemed to affect whether they were particles or waves. I heard an explanation that went like this. It's like if I were to commit to going out to dinner, taking Sharon out for a nice dinner tonight, and then a buddy of mine calls me at lunchtime and says, hey, I've got box seat tickets to see the Cubs and Cardinals play. My future action is affecting my present reality. And that's what these physicists are saying, that the future seems to affect the past. At the quantum level, in other words, time appears to move backwards. And is that bizarre or what? Now, of course, New Agers, who really annoy quantum physicists, by the way, from what I can tell, New Agers would look at this and say, well, this is just more proof that we can manipulate reality with our minds. If we're just living in a matrix, essentially. A reality doesn't exist until we observe it, which was another conclusion from this experiment, at the quantum level, of course. A reality doesn't exist until we observe it. And how we observe it affects reality, and our future actions affect our behavior in the past. We can change everything around us by, again, all of this applies at the quantum level, and it doesn't really apply at the macro level. Even though the New Agers claim it does. It's the whole principle, basically, behind the law of attraction, mind over matter. And that's why people like Josh Peck and Chuck Missler talk about this and write about this, because as Christians, we understand that regardless of how you want to define a reality, it is still reality. You are not going to step into moving traffic and close your eyes and have reality disappear. In fact, I think it's pretty cool to consider the possibility that the reason that you and I have physicality at all, the reason that we exist, the reason that this table in front of me is solid, even though I know that at the atomic level, there's a lot more space between the little bits that make up the atom, is because we're constantly being observed by the omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent creator of all things. Pretty cool. But sadly, there are some who don't get that and assume that guys like Chuck and Josh are trying to lead people into the New Age, which is exactly 180 degrees opposite of what they're trying to do. And one final thing, and again, I think this is really cool, but this is really not a new story. Scientists at the Imperial Museum of London. Is that right? Imperial Museum? Anyway, researchers in London, paleontologists, looked at some fragments of dinosaur bones that were dug up in Canada about 100 years ago and found that in these bones, which they estimate to be about 75 million years old, that there is collagen and blood that has been preserved. Collagen and blood cells. Now, this is kind of a wow. But it's not a new story. In 2005, Dr. Mary Schweitzer at North Carolina State University announced that she had discovered collagen in the leg bone of a Tyrannosaurus rex, and not just preserved, but she said it was still essentially fresh, that it was still flexible. So the question then becomes, how in the world does collagen, which is comprised of relatively fragile proteins, blood cells, how are they preserved for 75 million years? There was a study done in 2002 by scientists who estimated that at the rate of decay observed in science, that under perfect conditions, meaning 0 degrees Celsius, that's freezing, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, at freezing temperatures, the maximum, the upper limit for preservation of collagen is about 2.7 million years. 2.7 million years. That's a lot less than 75 million or even 65 million when the dinosaurs were supposed to have shuffled off this mortal coil because of the killer asteroid. But rather than rethink the timeline, science has decided to try to research how you get collagen to stay fresh for 75 million years. And the best theory they've got so far is that iron in dinosaur blood somehow preserved the collagen, even though I thought iron in blood was a source of free radicals, which help break tissue down. But what do I know? I'm not a scientist. These fragments of bones, by the way, were not preserved under ideal conditions. One researcher described the conditions of the bones, which were a mixture, kind of a jumble. One was from a theropod, you know, the big meat eaters like Gorgosaurus, Tyrannosaurus. One was from a triceratops, like a toe bone. And then they had a leg bone from a duck-billed dinosaur. And the researcher described their condition as, and I quote, crap. So not ideal preservation conditions. Researchers looking at the preservation of collagen back in that 2002 study found that if you raise the temperature from 0 degrees Celsius to 10 degrees Celsius, which is like 50 Fahrenheit, the upper limit for collagen preservation is about 185,000 years. 185,000 years. So you just have to come up with a way to stretch that out by about a factor of 700 in order to explain the collagen in these dinosaur bones. And now because they found this not just in these bones, but in the T-Rex back in 05 and other bones, they're discovering, hey, wait a minute, maybe there's a lot more preserved collagen in blood. I suspect that this was being discovered prior to Mary Schweitzer in 05. She is a respected paleontologist, no question. But I think others were afraid to come out with this because it sounds so crazy. Because here what you've got are two mutually exclusive ideas. Science knows you can't keep collagen fresh for more than about 2.7 million years. But science knows that dinosaurs went away 65 million years ago. The difference between those two bits of knowledge, in air quotes, is that the information about collagen is actually based on science, observing and repeating an experiment, whereas the age of the dinosaurs is based on forensic analysis, which in the strictest sense of the word is not science, because you cannot observe and repeat the experiment to determine exactly how old those bones are. But anyway, it's amusing to watch. And I'm not getting into young Earth, old Earth. I don't want to get into that argument. I'm just saying, you know, here's some evidence, and this is evidence that seems to be pretty solidly based on observable, repeatable experimentation. Should not the timeline be rethought? Ain't going to happen. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we will talk with John Wilkerson. We've not had him on the program for quite some time, and I think the last time he was on, he was hosting the podcast The Jesus Geek. This might have been like show number 2. On A View from the Bunker. And what are we up to now? Number 250, not counting the specials recorded at conferences. So he is now up to about show number 150-something on his new podcast, which is a much-needed podcast dealing with technology and homeschooling called The Wired Homeschool. What prompted this conversation was the news and all the attention that's been paid to the Duggar family after the revelation that Josh Duggar had inappropriate sexual contact with his sister when they were younger. Skeptics in our society, both from the right and from the left in the media, supporting the idea that we need government schools, are using this as an opportunity to question the wisdom of homeschooling one's children. So we'll talk about homeschooling and some of the challenges that homeschoolers face with John Wilkerson. That will be posted Sunday, June 14th. And then on the 17th of June, we talked to John McTernan. We'll actually talk to him before then, but you'll hear the program then. John McTernan has a book coming out on Defender Publishing, and it's been a while since we've spoken to him. Last time we talked about his book, As America Has Done to Israel. And he's also host of the Looking for Blessed Hope radio show, which and John, through his ministry, is having an impact on the far side of the world. So we'll talk about that. John McTernan, our guest on June 17th. Hope to have Reverend Dr. Christopher Bennick on the program soon. he recently posted an essay to the internet arguing that Christians should now embrace transhumanism, that the time has come for us to embrace it and try to guide it and direct it from a biblical perspective. I'm not sure I agree with that, but we'll find out where he differs in his approach to transhumanism and his reasons for supporting it from some of the leading lights in the movement, such as Zoltan Istvan, Dr. Natasha Vita Moore, Max Moore, and folks like that. But we'll post that information as soon as we confirm a time to talk to Reverend Benek, hopefully, like I said, very soon. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, we have switched from doing it live on Sunday mornings to uploading the Bible study on Sunday mornings, mainly due to the technical issue of living in the country and having to go to with a satellite internet service. So it does not play well with Blog Talk Radio, unfortunately, but we'll continue our study of the book of Leviticus, and you'll hear that at gilberthouse.org as we upload our Bible study on Sunday morning. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to download this audio into your ear holes, and we encourage you to join us on Facebook. Find the View from the Bunker page there and give us a like. Weigh in on the topics that we discuss here on the program, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, no, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.